lonely and forsaken. He listened with his head tilted back and his eyelids nearly closed, while fantastical images roiled within his mind, images that the fail nerve had induced, but that the music shaped. As it progressed, the melody grew ever more wild, and what had been plaintive became urgent, and the notes trilled up and down in a manner so fast, so insistent, so complicated, so alarming, that Aragorn began to fear for the safety of the musician. To play that quickly and that skillfully seemed unnatural, even for an elf. Arya laughed as the music reached a particularly fevered pitch, and she leaped to her feet and struck a pose, lifting her arms over her head. She stamped her foot against the ground and clapped her hands once, twice, three times. And then, much to Aragorn's astonishment, she began to dance. Her movements were slow at first, almost languorous. But soon her pace increased until she matched the frenzied beat of the music. The music soon peaked, then began to gradually subside as the piper restated and resolved the themes of the melody. But before the music ceased, a sudden itch made Aragorn grab his right hand and scratch at the palm. At the same moment he felt a twinge in the back of his mind as one of his wards flared to life, warning him of some danger. A second later, a dragon roared overhead. Cold fear stabbed through Aragorn. The roar did not belong to Saphira. The Word of a Rider. Aragorn grabbed Brisinger, and then he and Arya dashed from the tent. Outside, Aragorn staggered and fell to one knee, as the ground seemed to pitch underneath him. He clutched at a tuft of grass, using it as an anchor, while he waited for the dizziness to abate. When he dared look up, he squinted. The light from the nearby torches was painfully bright. The flames swam before him like fish, as if detached from the oil-soaked rags that fed them. "Balance is gone," thought Aragorn. "Can't trust my vision. Have to clear my mind. Have to..." A patch of motion caught his eye, and he ducked. Saphira's tail swept over him, passing only inches above his head, then struck his tent and flattened it, breaking the wooden poles like so many dry twigs. Saphira snarled, snapping at the empty air as she struggled to her feet. Then she paused, confused.
"Little one, what?"
A sound like a mighty wind interrupted her, and from out of the blackness of the sky there emerged Thorn, red as blood and glittering like a million shifting stars. He landed close to Nasuada's pavilion, and the earth shook from the impact of his weight. Aragorn heard Nasuada's guard shouting, then Thorn swung his right forepaw across the ground, and half the shouts went silent. From rigging strapped to the sides of the red dragon, several dozen soldiers leaped down and spread outward, stabbing into tents and cutting down the watchmen who ran at them. Horns blared along the perimeter of the camp. At the same time, the sounds of combat erupted near their outer defences, marking, Aragorn thought, a secondary attack from the north. "How many soldiers are there?" he wondered. "Are we surrounded?" Panic blossomed within him so strongly that it almost overrode his sense of reason and sent him running blindly into the night. Only the knowledge that the fail nerve was responsible for his reaction held him in place. He whispered a quick healing spell, hoping it might counteract the effects of the liqueur, but to no avail. Disappointed, he carefully stood, drew Brisinger, and joined Arya to stand shoulder to shoulder with her as five soldiers ran toward them. Aragorn was not sure how he and Arya could fight them off, not in their condition. The men were less than 20 feet away when Saphira growled and slapped the ground with her tail, knocking the soldiers over. Aragorn, who had sensed what Saphira was about to do, grabbed Arya and she grabbed him, and by supporting each other, they were able to remain upright. Then Blodgarm and another elf, Laufin, sprinted out of the maze of tents and slew the five soldiers before they could regain their footing. The other elves followed close behind. Another group of soldiers, this one over 20 strong, ran toward Aragorn and Arya, almost as if the men knew where to find them. The elves arranged themselves in a line in front of Aragorn and Arya, but before the soldiers came within reach of the elves' swords, one of the tents burst open, and Angela charged howling into the midst of the soldiers, catching them by surprise. The herbalist was wearing a red nightgown, her curly hair was in disarray, and in each hand she wielded a wool comb. The combs were 3 feet long and had two rows of steel tines mounted at an angle on the ends. The tines were longer than Aragorn's forearm and were sharpened to needle-like points. He knew that if you pricked yourself, you would catch blood poisoning from the unwashed wool they had been drawn through. Two of the soldiers fell as Angela buried the wool combs in their sides, driving the tines right through their hauberks. The herbalist was more than a foot shorter than some of the men, but she showed no sign of fear as she bounded among them. To the contrary, she was the picture of ferocity, with her wild hair and her shouting and her dark-eyed expression. The soldiers encircled Angela and closed in around her, hiding her from sight, and for a moment Aragorn feared they would overwhelm her. Then from elsewhere in the camp, he saw Solemnbum racing toward the knot of soldiers, the weercat's ears pressed flat against his skull. More weercats trailed him, 20, 30, 40, a whole pack, and all in their animal forms. A cacophony of hisses, yowls, and screams filled the night as the weercats sprang upon the soldiers and pulled them to the ground, tearing at them with claws and teeth. The soldiers fought back as best they could, but they were no match for the large shaggy cats. The whole sequence, from Angela's appearance to the intervention of the weercats, transpired with such speed, Aragorn barely had time to react. As the weercats swarmed the soldiers, he blinked and wet his parched mouth, feeling a sense of unreality about everything around him. Then Saphira said,
"Quick, onto my back!"
And she crouched so he could climb onto her. "Wait," said Arya, and put a hand on his arm. She murmured a few phrases in the ancient language. An instant later, the distortion of Aragorn's senses vanished, and he again found himself in full command of his body. He gave Arya a grateful glance, then tossed Brisinga's scabbard onto the remains of his tent, scrambled up Saphira's right foreleg, and settled into his usual position at the base of her neck. Without a saddle, the sharp edges of her scales dug into the insides of his legs, a feeling he well remembered from their first flight together.
"We need the Dalfdert," he shouted down to Arya.
She nodded and ran toward her own tent, which was several hundred feet away on the eastern side of the camp. Another consciousness, not Saphira's, pressed against Aragorn's mind, and he drew in his thoughts to protect himself. Then he realized the being was Glaedah, and he allowed the golden dragon past his guard.
"I will help," said Glaedah.
Behind his words, Aragorn sensed a terrible, seething anger directed at Thorne and Murtagh, an anger that seemed powerful enough to burn the world to cinders.
"Join your minds with me, Aragorn, Saphira, and you as well, Blodgarm, and you, Laufin, and the rest of your kind. Let me see with your eyes, and let me listen with your ears, so that I can advise you as to what to do, and so that I can lend you my strength when needed."
Saphira leaped forward, half flying, half gliding over the rows of tents, toward the huge ruby mass of Thorn. The elves followed below, killing what soldiers they encountered. Saphira had the advantage of height, as Thorn was still on the ground. She angled toward him, intending, Aragorn knew, to alight on Thorn's back and fix her jaws upon his neck. But as he saw her coming, the red dragon snarled and twisted to face her, crouching like a smaller dog confronting a larger one. Aragorn just had time to notice that Thorn's saddle was empty, and then the dragon reared and batted at Saphira with one of his thick, muscular forelegs. His heavy paw swung through the air with a loud rushing sound. In the gloom, his claws appeared startlingly white. Saphira veered to the side, contorting her body to avoid the blow. The ground and the sky tilted around Aragorn, and he found himself looking up at the camp as the tip of Saphira's right wing tore apart someone's tent. The force of the turn tugged on Aragorn, pulling him away from Saphira.
as scales started to slip out from between his legs. He clenched his thighs and tightened his hold on the spike in front of him, but Sephira's motion was too violent to withstand, and a second later his grip gave way, and he found himself tumbling through the air without a clear idea of which direction was up and which was down. Even as he fell, he made sure to maintain his grasp on Brisinga and to keep the blade well away from his body. Wards or no wards, the sword could still injure him due to Runon's spellwork.
"Little one!"
"Let her!" Aragorn shouted, and with a jolt, he stopped dead in the air, no more than 10 feet above the ground. While the world seemed to keep spinning for another few seconds, he glimpsed Sephira's sparkling outline as she circled around to retrieve him. Thorn bellowed and sprayed the rows of tents between him and Aragorn with a layer of white-hot flames that leaped up toward the sky. Screams of agony swiftly followed as the men within burned to death. Aragorn raised a hand to shield his face. His magic protected him from serious injury, but the heat was uncomfortable. "I'm fine. Don't turn back," he said, not only to Sephira, but also to Gleda and the elves. "You have to stop them. I'll meet you by Nasawada's pavilion." Sephira's disapproval was palpable, but she altered her course to resume her attack on Thorn. Aragorn released his spell and dropped to the ground. He landed lightly on the balls of his feet, then set off at a run between the burning tents, many of which were already collapsing, sending up pillars of orange sparks. The smoke and the stench of burnt wool made it hard for Aragorn to breathe. He coughed, and his eyes began to water, blurring the lower part of his vision. Several hundred feet ahead, Sephira and Thorn tussled, two giants in the night. Aragorn felt a sense of primal fear. What was he doing running toward them? Toward a pair of snapping, snarling creatures, each larger than a house, larger than two houses in Thorn's case, and each with claws, fangs, spikes larger than his whole body. Even after the initial surge of fear subsided, a small amount of trepidation remained as he raced ahead. He hoped Roran and Katrina were safe. Their tent was on the opposite side of the camp, but Thorn and the soldiers might turn in that direction at any moment. "Aragorn!" Arya loped through the burning debris, carrying the Dauthdert in her left hand. A faint green nimbus surrounded the barbed blade of the lance, although the glow was hard to see against the backdrop of flames. Trotting alongside her was Oric, who barreled through the tongues of fire as if they were no more dangerous than wisps of vapor. The dwarf was shirtless and helmetless. He held the ancient warhammer Volund in one hand and a small round shield in the other. Blood smeared both ends of the hammer. Aragorn greeted him with a raised hand and a cry, glad to have his friends with him. When she caught up, Arya offered him the lance, but Aragorn shook his head. "Keep it," he said. "We'll have a better chance of stopping Thorn if you use Nirnan and I use Brisinga." Arya nodded and tightened her grip on the lance. For the first time, Aragorn wondered if, as an elf, she would be able to bring herself to kill a dragon. Then he put the thought aside. If there was one thing he knew about Arya, it was that she always did what was necessary, no matter how difficult. Thorn clawed Sephira's ribs, and Aragorn gasped as he felt her pain through their bond. From Blodgarm's mind, he gathered that the elves were close to the dragons, busy fighting the soldiers. Not even they dared move any nearer to Sephira and Thorn, for fear of being crushed underfoot.
"Over there,"
said Oric, and pointed with his hammer toward a cluster of soldiers moving through the rows of destroyed tents.
"Leave them," said Arya. "We have to help Sephira."
Oric grunted.
"Right then, off we go."
The three of them dashed forward, but Aragorn and Arya soon left Oric far behind. No dwarf could hope to keep up with them, not even one as strong and fit as Oric.
"Go on," shouted Oric from behind. "I'll follow as fast as I can."
As Aragorn dodged scraps of burning fabric that were floating through the air, he spotted Nargajvog amid a knot of 10 soldiers. The horned Carl appeared grotesque by the ruddy light of the flames. His lips were drawn back from his fangs, and the shadows on his heavy brow ridge gave his face a crude, brutal look, as if his skull had been hacked out of a boulder with a dull chisel. Fighting bare-handed, he grabbed a soldier and tore him limb from limb as easily as Aragorn might tear apart a roast chicken. A few paces later, the burning tents ended. On the other side of the flames, all was confusion. Blodgarm and two of his spellcasters stood facing four black-robed men, who Aragorn assumed were magicians of the Empire. Neither the men nor the elves stirred, though their faces displayed immense strain. Dozens of soldiers lay dead on the ground, but others still ran free, some bearing wounds so horrendous that Aragorn knew at once the men were immune to pain. He could not see the rest of the elves, but he could sense their presence on the other side of Nasawada's red pavilion, which stood in the center of the havoc. Groups of werecats chased soldiers back and forth throughout the clearing around the pavilion. King Halfpaw and his mate Shadowhunter led two of the groups. Solombum led a third. Close to the pavilion stood the herbalist, dueling with a large, burly man, she fighting with her wool combs, he with a mace in one hand and a flail in the other. The two seemed fairly matched, despite their differences in sex, weight, height, reach, and equipment. To Aragorn's surprise, Elva was there as well, sitting on the end of a barrel. The witch-child had her arms wrapped around her stomach and appeared deathly ill, but she too was participating in the battle, albeit in her own unique way. Clustered before her were a dozen soldiers, and Aragorn saw that she was speaking rapidly to them, her small mouth moving in a blur. As she spoke, each man reacted differently. One stood fixed in place, seemingly unable to move. One cringed and covered his face with his hands. One knelt and stabbed himself in the chest with a long dagger. Another flung down his weapons and ran off through the camp, and still another babbled like a fool. None lifted their swords against her, and none went on to attack anyone else. And looming above the mayhem, like two living mountains, were Saphira and Thorn. They had moved off to the left of the pavilion and were circling each other, trampling row after row of tents. Tongues of flame flickered in the pits of their nostrils and in the gaps between their saber-like teeth. Aragorn hesitated. The welter of sounds and motions was hard to take in, and he was uncertain where he was needed most.
"Murtagh?" he asked Gleda.
"We've yet to find him, if he's even here. I can't feel his mind. But it's hard to know for sure with so many people and spells in one place."
Through their link, Aragorn could tell that the Golden Dragon was doing far more than just talking to him. Gleda was listening simultaneously to the thoughts of Saphira and the elves, as well as helping Blodgarm and his two companions in their mental struggle against the Empire's magicians. Aragorn was confident that they would be able to defeat the magicians, just as he was confident that Angela and Elva were perfectly capable of defending themselves from the rest of the soldiers. Saphira, however, was already wounded in several places, and she was hard-pressed to keep Thorn from attacking the rest of the camp. Aragorn glanced at the Dauth Dert in Arya's hand, then back at the massive shapes of the dragons.
"We have to kill him," Aragorn thought, and his heart grew heavy. Then his eye fell on Elva, and a new idea took root in his mind. The girl's words were more powerful than any weapon. No one, not even Galba Torix, could withstand them. If she could but speak to Thorn, she could drive him away.
"No,"
growled Gleda.
"You waste time, youngling. Go to your dragon now. She needs your help. You must kill Thorn, not scare him into fleeing. He is broken, and there is nothing you can do to save him."
Aragorn looked at Arya, and she looked at him. "Elva would be faster," he said.
"We have the Dauth Dert.
Too dangerous, too difficult." Arya hesitated, then nodded. Together they started toward Elva. Before they reached her, Aragorn heard a muffled scream. He turned and to his horror saw Murtagh striding out of the pavilion, dragging Nasawada by her wrists. Nasawada's hair was disheveled. A nasty scratch marred one of her cheeks, and her yellow dressing gown was torn in several places. She kicked at Murtag's knee, but her heel bounced off a ward, leaving Murtag untouched. He pulled her closer with a cruel tug, then struck her on the temple with the pommel of Zarok, knocking her unconscious. Aragorn yelled and swerved toward them. Murtag gave him a brief look, then he sheathed his sword, hoisted Nasawada onto a shoulder, and knelt on one knee, where he bowed his head as if in prayer. A spike of pain from Saphira distracted Aragorn, and she cried,
"Beware! He's escaped me!"
As Aragorn leaped over a mound of corpses, he risked a quick glance upward and saw Thorn's glittering belly and velvet wings blotting out half the stars in the sky. The red dragon spun slightly as he drifted downward like a large weighted leaf. Aragorn dove to the side and rolled behind the pavilion, trying to put distance between himself and the dragon. A rock dug into his shoulder as he landed. Without slowing, Thorn reached down with his right foreleg, which was as thick and knotted as a tree trunk, and closed his enormous paw around Murtag and Nasawada. His claws sank into the earth, excavating a plug of dirt several feet deep as he picked up the two humans. Then with a triumphant roar and the bone-jarring thuds of flapping wings, Thorn arched upward and started to climb away from the camp. From where she and Thorn had been grappling, Saphira took off in pursuit, streamers of blood unfurling from bites and claw marks along her limbs. She was faster than Thorn, but even if she caught him, Aragorn could not imagine how she could rescue Nasawada without injuring her. A breath of wind tugged at his hair as Arya sped past him. She ran up a pile of barrels and jumped, and her leap carried her high into the air, higher than any elf could jump without assistance. Reaching out, she grabbed hold of Thorn's tail and hung dangling from it like an ornament. Aragorn took a half step forward as if to stop her, then cursed and growled, "Alder!" The spell launched him into the sky like an arrow from a bow. He reached out to Gleda, and the old dragon fed him energy to sustain his ascension. Aragorn burned the energy without heed, not caring the price, only wanting to reach Thorn before something horrible happened to Nasawada or Arya. As he hurtled past Saphira, Aragorn watched as Arya began to climb up Thorn's tail. She clung to the spikes along his spine with her right hand, using them like the rungs on a ladder. With her left, she plunged the Dauthdert into Thorn, anchoring herself with the blade of the spear, even as she pulled herself higher and higher up his heaving body. Thorn wriggled and twisted and snapped at her, like a horse irritated by a fly, but he could not reach her. Then the blood-red dragon drew in his wings and legs, and with his precious cargo cradled close to his chest, he dove toward the ground, spinning round and round in a death spiral. The Dauthdert tore loose from Thorn's flesh, and Arya stretched out at an angle to him as she held onto a spike with only her right hand, her weak hand, the hand she had injured in the catacombs under Druss Leona. Ere long, her fingers loosened, and she fell away from Thorn, her arms and legs flung outward like the spokes of a wagon wheel. No doubt the result of a spell she had cast, her gyrations slowed and then ceased, as did her downward trajectory, until at last she floated upright in the night sky. Illuminated by the glow of the Dauthdert which he still held, she appeared to Aragorn like a green firefly hovering in the darkness. Thorn flared his wings and looped back toward her. Arya's head swiveled as she looked over at Saphira. Then she rotated in the air to face Thorn. A malefic light sprang into existence between Thorn's jaws, an instant before an ever-expanding wall of flames billowed out of his maw and rolled over Arya, obscuring her form. By then, Aragorn was less than 50 feet away, close enough that the heat stung his cheeks. The flames cleared to reveal Thorn turning away from Arya, doubling back on himself as quickly as his bulk would allow. As he did, he swung his tail, whipping it through the air faster than she could hope to evade. "No!" shouted Aragorn. There was a crack as the tail struck Arya. It knocked her into the darkness like a stone loosed from a sling, and the Dalthdert separated from her and arced downward, its glow dwindling to a faint point that soon vanished altogether. Iron bands seemed to tighten around Aragorn's chest, squeezing the breath out of him. Thorn was pulling away, but Aragorn might still be able to overtake the dragon if he drew even more energy from Glaedor. However, his connection with Glaedor was growing tenuous, and Aragorn could not hope to best Thorn and Murtagh alone, and high above the ground. Not when Murtagh had dozens more Eldunari at his disposal. Aragorn swore, cut off the spell that was propelling him through the air, and dove headfirst after Arya. The wind screamed in his ears and tore at his hair and clothes, and mashed the skin on his cheeks flat, and forced him to narrow his eyes to slits. An insect struck him on the neck. The impact stung as fiercely as if he had been hit by a pebble. As he fell, Aragorn searched with his mind for Arya's consciousness. He had just sensed a glimmer of awareness somewhere in the gloom below, when Saphira shot out beneath him, her scales muted in the light of the stars. She turned upside down, and Aragorn saw her reach out and catch a small, dark object with her forepaws. A jolt of pain went through the mind Aragorn had touched. Then all thought ceased within it, and he felt no more.
"I have her, little one," said Saphira.
"Let her," Aragorn said, and he slowed to a halt. He looked for Thorn again, but saw only stars and blackness. To the east he heard twice the indistinct sound of flapping wings. Then all was silent. Aragorn looked toward the Vardens' camp. Patches of fire glowed orange and sullen through layers of smoke. Hundreds of tents lay crumpled in the dirt, along with however many men had failed to escape before Saphira and Thorn trampled them. But those men were not the only victims of the attack. From his height, Aragorn could not pick out the bodies, but he knew the soldiers had killed scores. The taste of ashes filled Aragorn's mouth. He was shaking. Tears of rage and fear and frustration clouded his eyes. Arya was injured, perhaps dead. Nasawada was gone, captured. And soon she would be at the mercy of Galbatorix's most skilled torturers. Hopelessness overcame Aragorn. How could they continue now? How could they possibly hope for victory without Nasawada to lead them? Conclave of Kings. Upon landing in the Varden's camp with Saphira, Aragorn slid down her side and ran to the patch of grass where she had gently deposited Arya. The elf lay face down, limp and motionless. When Aragorn rolled her over, her eyes flickered open.
"Thorn, what of Thorn?" she whispered.
"He escaped," said Saphira.
"And Nasawada? Did you rescue her?"
Aragorn looked down and shook his head. Sorrow passed over Arya's face. She coughed and winced, then started to sit up. A thread of blood trickled from the corner of her mouth.
"Wait," said Aragorn. "Don't move. I'll fetch Blodgarm." "There's no need."
Grasping his shoulder, Arya pulled herself onto her feet, then gingerly rose to her full height. Her breath caught as her muscles stretched, and Aragorn saw the pain she was trying to hide.
"I'm only bruised, not broken. My wards protected me from the worst of Thorn's blow."
Aragorn was doubtful, but he accepted her statement.
"What now?"
asked Saphira, moving closer to them. The sharp, musky smell of her blood was thick in Aragorn's nostrils. Aragorn looked around at the flames and destruction in the camp. Again he thought of Rohan and Katrina and wondered if they had survived the attack. What now, indeed? Circumstances answered his question. First, a pair of wounded soldiers ran out of a bank of smoke and attacked him and Arya. By the time Aragorn dispatched them, 8 of the elves had converged upon their location. After Aragorn convinced them he was unharmed,
The elves turned their attention to Saphira and insisted on healing the bites and scratches Thorn had given her, even though Aragorn would have preferred to do it himself. Knowing that the healing was going to require several minutes, Aragorn left Saphira with the elves and hurried back through the rows of tents to the area near Nasawada's pavilion, where Blodgarm and the two other elven spellcasters were still locked in mental combat with the last of the four enemy magicians. The remaining magician was kneeling on the ground, his brow pressed against his knees and his arms wrapped around the nape of his neck. Instead of adding his thoughts to the invisible fray, Aragorn strode over to the magician, tapped him on the shoulder, and shouted, "Ha!" The magician quivered, startled, and the distraction allowed the elves to slip past his defenses. This Aragorn knew, because the man convulsed and then rolled over, the whites of his eyes showing, and a yellowish foam bubbled out of his mouth. Soon afterward, he ceased breathing. With clipped sentences, Aragorn explained to Blodgarm and the two other elves what had happened to Arya and Nasawada. Blodgarm's fur bristled, and his yellow eyes burned with anger. But his only comment was to say in the ancient language, "Dark times are upon us, Shadeslayer." Then he sent Yela to find and retrieve the Dauthdert from wherever it had fallen. Together, Aragorn, Blodgarm, and Uthinare, the elf who had stayed with them, ranged through the camp, rounding up and killing the few soldiers who had escaped the teeth of the Weircats and the blades of the men, dwarves, elves, and Urgles. They also used their magic to extinguish some of the larger blazes, snuffing them out as easily as the flame of a candle. The whole while, an overwhelming sense of dread clutched at Aragorn, pressing down on him like a pile of sodden fleeces, and constricting his mind so that he found it difficult to think of anything other than death, defeat, and failure. He felt as if the world were crumbling around him, as if everything he and the Varden had striven to accomplish was unspooling rapidly, and there was nothing he could do to regain control. The sense of helplessness sapped his will to do anything other than sit in a corner and give in to misery. Still, he refused to satisfy the urge, for if he did, then he might as well be dead. So he kept moving, laboring alongside the elves in spite of his despair. It did not improve his mood when Glada contacted him and said,
"If you had listened to me, we might have stopped Thorn and saved Nasawada."
"And we might not have," said Aragorn. He did not want to discuss the subject further, but felt compelled to add, "You let your anger cloud your sight. Killing Thorn wasn't the only solution, nor should you have been so quick to destroy one of the only remaining members of your kind."
"Do not think to lecture me, youngling," snapped Glada. "You cannot begin to understand what I have lost."
"I understand better than most," Aragorn replied. But Glada had already withdrawn from his mind, and Aragorn did not think the dragon heard him. Aragorn had just put out one fire and was moving to the next, when Roran hurried to him and grasped his arm. "Are you hurt?" Relief swept through Aragorn as he saw his cousin alive and well. "No," he said. "And Saphira?" "The elves have already mended her wounds. What of Katrina? Is she safe?" Roran nodded, and his posture relaxed slightly, but his expression remained troubled. "Aragorn," he said, drawing closer, "what's happened? What is happening? I saw Jormungandr running around like a chicken with its head cut off, and Nasawada's guards look grim as death, and I can't get anyone to talk to me. Are we still in danger? Is Galbatorix about to attack?" Aragorn glanced around, then drew Roran to the side, where no one else could hear. "You can't tell anyone. Not yet," he cautioned. "You have my word." With a few quick sentences, Aragorn summarized the situation to Roran. By the time he finished, Roran's expression had grown bleak. "We can't let the Varden disband," he said. "Of course not. That won't happen. But King Orin may try to assume command, or—" Aragorn fell silent as a group of warriors passed nearby. Then, "Stay with me, will you? I may need your help."
"My help? For what would you need my help?"
The whole army admires you, Roran, even the Urgals. You're Stronghammer, the hero of Aros, and your opinion carries weight. That might prove important.
Roran was silent for a moment, then nodded. I'll do what I can.
For now, just keep watch for soldiers, said Aragorn,
and continued toward the fire that was his intended destination. Half an hour later, as quiet and order had begun to settle over the camp again, a runner informed Aragorn that Arya desired his immediate presence in King Oryk's pavilion. Aragorn and Roran exchanged glances, then set out toward the northwestern quadrant of the camp, where the majority of the dwarves had pitched their tents.
There is no choice, said Jormungandr. Nasawada made her wishes perfectly clear. You, Aragorn, must take her place and lead the Varden in her stead.
The faces ringing the interior of the tent were stern and unyielding. Dark shadows clung to the hollows of their temples and to the deep frown lines of the assorted two legs, as Aragorn knew Saphira would have called them. The only one not frowning was Saphira. Her head was pushed through the entrance to the pavilion so that she could participate in the conclave, but her lips were pulled back slightly, as if she was about to snarl. Also present were King Orin, a purple cloak wrapped over his night robes, Arya, looking shaken but determined, King Oryk, who had found a male shirt to cover himself, the Weircat King Grimur Halfpaw, a white linen bandage wrapped around a sword cut on his right shoulder, Nar Garjvog, the Cull, stooping to avoid brushing his horns against the ceiling, and Roran, who stood by the wall of the tent, listening to the proceedings, so far without comment. No one else had been allowed into the pavilion, not guards, not advisers, not servants, not even Blodgarm or the other elves. Outside, a block of men, dwarves, and Urgals stood 12 deep before the entrance, their task to prevent anyone, no matter how powerful or dangerous, from interfering with the meeting. And woven about the tent were a number of hastily cast spells, intended to prevent eavesdropping, both mundane and magical.
I never wanted this, said Aragorn, staring down at the map of Alagasia stretched out on the table in the center of the pavilion.
None of us did, said King Orin in a biting tone.
It had been wise of Arya, Aragorn thought, to stage the meeting in Oryk's pavilion. The Dwarf King was known to be a staunch supporter of Nasawada and the Varden, as well as being Aragorn's clan chief and foster brother. But no one could accuse him of aspiring to Nasawada's position, nor would the humans necessarily accept him as her replacement. Still, by staging the meeting in Oryk's pavilion, Arya had strengthened Aragorn's case and undercut his critics, without appearing to endorse or attack either. She was, Aragorn had to admit, far more accomplished at manipulating others than he. The only risk in what she had done was that it might cause others to think Oryk was his master. But that was a risk Aragorn was willing to accept in exchange for his friend's support.
I never wanted this, he repeated, then lifted his gaze to meet the watchful eyes of those around him. But now that it's happened, I swear on the graves of all we've lost that I'll do my best to live up to Nasawada's example and lead the Varden to victory against Galbatorix and the Empire. He strove to project an air of confidence, but the truth was, the enormity of the situation frightened him, and he had no idea whether he was up to the task. Nasawada had been impressively capable, and it was intimidating to consider trying to do even half of what she had done.
"Very commendable, I'm sure," said King Orin. However, the Varden has always worked in concert with its allies, with the men of Cirda, with our royal friend King Oryk and the dwarves of the Beor Mountains, with the elves, and now more recently with the Urgals, as led by Nar Garjvag, and with the Weircats.
He nodded toward Grimur, who nodded briefly in return.
It would not do for the rank and file to see us disagreeing with one another in public. Would you not agree?
Of course.
Of course, said King Orin. I take it, then, you will continue to consult with us on matters of importance, even as Nasawada did.
Aragorn hesitated, but before he could reply, Orin resumed speaking.
All of us,
he motioned toward the others in the tent, "have risked an enormous amount in this venture, and none of us would appreciate being dictated to, nor would we submit to it. To be blunt, despite your many accomplishments, Aragorn Shadeslayer, you are still young and inexperienced, and that inexperience might very well prove fatal. The rest of us have had the benefit of many years leading our respective forces, or watching others lead. We can help guide you onto the right path, and perhaps together we can still find a way to right this mess and overthrow Galbatorix." Everything Orin said was true, Aragorn thought. He was still young and inexperienced, and he did need the others' advice. But he could not admit as much without appearing weak. So instead he replied, "You may rest assured that I will consult with you when needed, but my decisions, as always, will remain my own. Forgive me, Shadeslayer, but I have difficulty believing that. Your familiarity with the elves," Orin eyed Arya, "is commonly known. What's more, you are an adopted member of the Injitum clan, and subject to the authority of their clan chief, who just so happens to be King Oryk. Perhaps I am mistaken, but it seems doubtful that your decisions will be your own. First you counsel me to listen to our allies, now you don't. Is it perhaps that you would prefer I listen to you, and you alone?" Aragorn's anger grew as he spoke. "I would prefer that your choices be in the best interests of our people, and not those of another race." "They have been," growled Aragorn, "and they will continue to be. I owe my allegiance to both the Varden and the Injitum clan, yes, but also to Saphira and Nasuada, and my family as well. Many have claim on me, even as many have claim on you, Your Majesty. My foremost concern, however, is defeating Galbatorix and the Empire. It always has been, and if there is a conflict among my loyalties, that is what shall take precedence. Question my judgment if you must, but do not question my motives. And I would thank you to refrain from implying that I am a traitor to my kind." Orin scowled, color rising in his cheeks, and he was about to utter a retort when a loud bang interrupted him, as Oryk struck his warhammer Volund against his shield.
"Enough of this nonsense," exclaimed Oryk, glowering. "You worry about a crack in the floor while the whole mountain is about to come down upon us."
Orin's scowl deepened, but he did not pursue the matter further. Instead, he picked up his goblet of wine from the table and sank back into the depths of his chair, where he stared at Aragorn with a dark, smouldering gaze.
"I think he hates you," said Saphira.
"That or he hates what I represent. Either way, I'm an obstacle to him. He'll bear watching."
"The question before us is simple," said Oryk. "What should we do now that Nasuada is gone?"
He placed Volund flat on the table and ran his gnarled hand over his head.
"Mine opinion is that our situation is the same as it was this morning. Unless we admit defeat and sue for peace, we still have only one choice. March to Uruvane as fast as our feet will carry us. Nasuada herself was never going to fight Galbatorix. That will fall to you."
He motioned toward Aragorn and Saphira.
"And the elves. Nasuada brought us this far, and while she will be greatly missed, we do not need her to continue. Our path allows for little deviation. Even if she were present, I cannot see her doing anything else. To Uruvane we must go, and that's the end of it."
Grimmer toyed with a small black-bladed dagger, seemingly indifferent to the conversation.
"I agree," said Arya. "We have no other choice."
Above them, Garjvarg's massive head dipped, causing misshapen shadows to glide across the pavilion walls.
"The dwarf speaks well. The Ur-Grulgra will stay with the Varden, as long as Firesword is war chief. With him and Flame Tongue to lead our charges, we will collect the debt of blood that the lack-horned betrayer Galbatorix still owes us.
Aragorn shifted slightly, uncomfortable.
That's all very well and good, said King Orin. But I've yet to hear how we are supposed to defeat Murtagh and Galbatorix when we get to Urubane.
We have the Dalthdert, Aragorn pointed out, for Yela had retrieved the spear. And with it we can... King Orin waved one hand. Yes, yes, the Dalthdert. It didn't help you stop Thorn, and I can't imagine that Galbatorix will let you come anywhere near him or Shrukan with it. Either way, it doesn't change the fact that you're still no match for that black-hearted traitor. Blast it, Shadeslayer, you're not even a match for your own brother, and he's been a rider for less time than you. Half-brother, Aragorn thought, but he held his tongue. He could find no way to rebut Orin's points. They were valid, each and every one, and they left him feeling shamed. The king continued, We entered this war with the understanding that you would find a way of countering Galbatorix's unnatural strength. So Nasawada promised and assured us. And yet here we are, about to confront the most powerful magician in recorded history, and we're no closer to defeating him than when we began. We went to war, Aragorn said quietly, because it was the first time since the riders fell that we've had even the slightest chance of overthrowing Galbatorix. You know that. What chance? Sneered the king. We're puppets, all of us, dancing according to Galbatorix's whims. The only reason we've gotten this far is because he's let us. Galbatorix wants us to go to Urubane. He wants us to bring you to him. If he cared about stopping us, he would have flown out to meet us at the Burning Plains and crushed us then and there. And once he has you in his reach, he'll do just that, crush us. The air in the tent seemed to grow taut between them.
Careful, said Saphira to Aragorn. He'll leave the pack if you can't convince him otherwise.
Arya appeared similarly worried. Aragorn spread his hands flat on the table and took a moment to gather his thoughts. He did not want to lie, but at the same time he had to find a way to inspire hope in Orin, which was difficult when Aragorn felt little himself. Is this what it was like for Nasawada, all those times she rallied us to the cause, convinced us to keep going, even when we couldn't see a way clear? Our position isn't quite as precarious as you make it out to be, said Aragorn. Orin snorted and drank from his goblet. The Dalthdert is a threat to Galbatorix, continued Aragorn, and that's to our advantage. He'll be wary of it. Because of that, we can force him to do what we want, perhaps just a bit. Even if we can't use it to kill him, we might be able to kill Shrukan. Theirs isn't a true pairing of dragon and rider, but Shrukan's death would still wound him to the core.
It'll never happen, said Orin. He knows that we have the Dalthdert now, and he'll take the appropriate precautions.
Maybe not. I doubt Murtagh and Thorn recognized it.
No, but Galbatorix will when he examines their memories.
And he'll also know of Glader's existence, if they haven't told him already,
Saphira said to Aragorn. Aragorn's spirits sank further. He had not thought of that, but she was right. So much for any hope of surprising him. We have no more secrets.
Life is full of secrets. Galbatorix cannot predict exactly how we will choose to fight him. In that, at least, we can confound him.
Which of the Death Spears have you found, O Shadeslayer?
Asked Grimmer, in a seemingly bored tone. Dunirnan, the orchid. The Weircat blinked, and Aragorn had the impression that he was surprised, although Grimmer's expression remained blank as ever.
The orchid? Is that so? How very strange to find such a weapon in this age, especially that particular weapon.
Why so?
Asked Jormungandr. Grimmer's small pink tongue passed over his fangs.
Nirnan is notorious.
He drew out the end of the word into a short hiss. Before Aragorn could press the weercat for more information, Garshvark spoke, his voice grinding like boulders.
What is this death spear you speak of, Fire Sword? Is it the lance that wounded Saphira in Bellatona? We heard tales of it, but they were odd indeed.
Aragorn belatedly remembered that Nasawada had told neither the Urgals nor the Weircats what Nirnan truly was. Oh well, he thought, it can't be helped. He explained to Garshvarg about the Dauthdert, then insisted everyone in the pavilion swear an oath in the ancient language that they would not discuss the spear with anyone else without permission. There was some grumbling, but in the end they all complied, even the Weircat. Trying to hide the spear from Galbatorix might have been pointless, but Aragorn could see no good in allowing the Dauthdert to become general knowledge. When the last of them had finished their oaths, Aragorn resumed speaking. So, first we have the Dauthdert, and that's more than we had before. Second, I don't plan on facing Murtagh and Galbatorix together. I've never planned to. When we arrive at Urabane, we'll lure Murtagh out of the city, and then we'll surround him, with the whole army if necessary, the elves included, and we'll kill or capture him once and for all. He looked round at the gathered faces, trying to impress them with the force of his conviction. Third, and this is what you have to believe deep in your hearts, Galbatorix isn't invulnerable, however powerful he is. He might have cast thousands upon thousands of wards to protect himself, but in spite of all his knowledge and cunning, there are still spells that can kill him, if only we are clever enough to think of them. Now maybe I'll be the one to find the spell that is his undoing, but it might just as well be an elf or a member of Duvrangal Gata. Galbatorix seems untouchable, I know, but there's always a weakness. There's always a crevice you can slip a blade through, and thus stab your foe. If the riders of old couldn't find his weakness, what is the likelihood we can? Demanded King Orin. Aragorn spread his hands, palms upward. Maybe we can't. Nothing is certain in life, much less in war. However, if the combined spellcasters of our five races can't kill him, then we might as well accept that Galbatorix is going to rule as long as he pleases, and nothing we can do is going to change that. Silence pervaded the tent, short and profound. Then Roran stepped forward.
I would speak, he said.
Aragorn saw the others around the table exchange glances.
Say what you will, Stronghammer,
said Oric, to King Orin's evident annoyance.
It is this. Too much blood and too many tears have been shed for us to turn back now. It would be disrespectful, both to the dead and to those who remember the dead. This may be a battle between gods.
He appeared perfectly serious to Aragorn as he said this.
But I, for one, will keep fighting until the gods strike me down, or until I strike them down. A dragon might kill 10,000 wolves one at a time, but 10,000 wolves together can kill a dragon.
Not likely,
Saphira snorted, in the privacy of her and Aragorn's shared mindspace. Roran smiled without humour.
And we have a dragon of our own. Decide as you wish. But I, for one, am going to Urabane, and I'll face Galbatorix, even if I have to do it by myself.
Not by yourself, said Arya. I know I speak for Queen Islanzadi when I say that our people will stand with you.
As will ours,
rumbled Garshvarg.
And ours,
affirmed Oric.
And ours,
Aragorn said, in a tone that he hoped would discourage dissent. When, after a pause, the four of them turned toward Grimmer, the Weircat sniffed and said,
Well, I suppose we'll be there too.
He inspected his sharp nails.
Someone has to sneak past enemy lines, and it certainly won't be the dwarves bumbling around in their iron boots.
Oryk's eyebrows rose, but if he was offended, he hid it well. Two more drinks, Orin quaffed. Then he wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and said,
Very well, as you wish. We'll continue on to Urubane.
His cup empty, he reached for the bottle in front of him.
A maze without end. Aragorn and the others spent the rest of the conclave discussing practicalities. Lines of communication, who was supposed to answer to whom, assignments of duty, rearrangements of the camp wards and sentinels to prevent Thorn or Shrooken from sneaking up on them again, and how to secure new equipment for the men whose belongings had been burned or squashed during the attack. By consensus, they decided to hold off announcing what had happened to Nasawada until the following day. It was more important for the warriors to get what sleep they could before dawn brightened the horizon. And yet the one thing they never discussed was whether they should try to rescue Nasawada. It was obvious that the only way to free her would be to seize Urubane, and by then she would probably be dead, injured, or bound to Galbatorix in the ancient language. So they avoided the subject entirely, as if to mention it was forbidden. Nevertheless, she was a constant presence in Aragorn's thoughts. Every time he closed his eyes, he saw Murtagh striking her, then the scaly fingers of Thorn's paw closing round her, and then the red dragon flying off into the night. The memories only made Aragorn more miserable, but he could not stop himself from reliving them. As the conclave dispersed, Aragorn motioned to Rohan, Jormungandr, and Arya. They followed him without question back to his tent, where Aragorn spent some time asking their advice and planning for the day to come.
The Council of Elders will give you some trouble, I'm sure, Jormungandr said. They don't consider you as skilled at politics as Nasawada, and they'll try to take advantage of that.
The long-haired warrior had appeared preternaturally calm since the attack, so much so that Aragorn suspected he was on the verge of either tears or rage, or perhaps a combination of both.
I'm not.
Jormungandr inclined his head.
Nevertheless, you must hold strong. I can help you some, but much will depend on how you comport yourself. If you allow them to unduly influence your decisions, they'll think they have inherited the leadership of the Varden, not you.
Aragorn glanced at Arya and Saphira, concerned.
Never fear, said Saphira to them all. No one shall get the better of him while I stand watch.
When their smaller, secondary meeting came to an end, Aragorn waited until Arya and Jormungandr had filed out of the tent. Then he caught Roland by the shoulder.
Did you mean what you said about this being a battle of the gods?
Roland stared at him.
I did. You and Murtagh and Galbatorix, you're too powerful for any normal person to defeat. It's not right, it's not fair, but so it is. The rest of us are like ants under your boots. Have you any idea how many men you've killed single-handedly?
Too many.
Exactly. I'm glad you're here to fight for us, and I'm glad to count you as my brother in all but name. But I wish we didn't have to rely on a rider or an elf or any sort of magician to win this war for us. No one should be at the mercy of another person, not like this. It unbalances the world.
Then Rohan strode out of the tent. Aragorn sank onto his cot, feeling as if he had been struck in the chest. He sat there for a while, sweating and thinking, until the strain of his overactive thoughts caused him to spring upright and hurry outside. As he exited the tent, the six Nighthawks jumped to their feet, readying their weapons to accompany him wherever he might be going. Aragorn motioned for them to stay put. He had protested, but Jormungandr insisted upon assigning Nasawada's guards, in addition to Blodgarm and the other elves, to protect him.
We can't be too careful, he had said.
Aragorn disliked having even more people following him around, but he had been forced to agree. Walking past the guards, Aragorn hurried over to where Saphira lay curled on the ground. She opened one eye as he neared, and then lifted her wing so he could crawl under it and nestle against her warm belly.
little one,"
she said, and began to hum softly. Aragorn sat against her, listening to her humming, and to the soft rustle of air flowing in and out of her mighty lungs. Behind him, her belly rose and fell, with a gentle, soothing cadence. At any other time, her presence would have been enough to calm him, but not now. His mind refused to slow, his pulse continued to hammer, and his hands and feet were uncomfortably hot. He kept his feelings to himself to avoid disturbing Saphira. She was tired after her two fights with Thorn, and she soon fell into a deep slumber, her humming fading into the ever-present sound of her breathing. And still Aragorn's thoughts would not give him rest. Over and over he returned to the same impossible, incontrovertible fact. He was the leader of the Varden. He, who had been nothing more than the youngest member of a poor farming family, was now the leader of the second-largest army in Alagazia. That it had happened at all seemed outrageous, as if fate was toying with him, baiting him into a trap that would destroy him. He had never wanted it, never sought it. And yet events had thrust it upon him. "What was Nasawada thinking when she chose me as her successor?" he wondered. He remembered the reasons she had given him, but they did nothing to alleviate his doubts. Did she really believe I could take her place? Why not Jormunda? He's been with the Varden for decades, and he knows so much more about command and strategy. Aragorn thought of when Nasawada had decided to accept the Urgal's offer of an alliance. In spite of all the hate and grief that existed between their two races, and even though it had been the Urgals who had killed her father, could I have done that? He imagined not, not then at least. Can I make those sorts of decisions now, if they're what's required to defeat Galbatorix? He was not sure. He made an effort to still his mind. Closing his eyes, he concentrated on counting his breaths in batches of 10. It was difficult to keep his attention focused on the task. Every few seconds, another thought or sensation would threaten to distract him, and he often forgot the count. In time, however, his body began to relax. And almost without his realizing it, the shifting rainbow visions of his waking dreams crept over him. Many things he saw, some grim and unsettling, as his dreams reflected the events of the past day. Others were bittersweet, memories of what had been, or what he wished could have been. Then, like a sudden change of wind, his dreams rippled and became harder and more substantial, as if they were tangible realities that he could reach out and touch. Everything around him faded away, and he beheld another time and place, one that seemed both strange and familiar, as if he had seen it once long before, and then it had passed from recollection. Aragorn opened his eyes, but the images stayed with him, obscuring his surroundings, and he knew that he was experiencing no normal dream. A dark and lonely plain lay before him, cut by a single strip of water that flowed slow-moving into the east, a ribbon of beaten silver bright beneath the glare of a full moon. Floating on the nameless river, a ship, tall and proud, with pure white sails raised and ready, ranks of warriors holding lances, and two hooded figures walking among them, as if in a stately procession. The smell of willows and cottonwoods, and a sense of passing sorrow. Then a man's anguished cry, and a flash of scales, and a muddle of motion that concealed more than it revealed, and then nothing but silence and blackness. Aragorn's sight cleared, and he again found himself looking at the underside of Saphira's wing. He released his pent-up breath, which he had not realized he was holding, and with a shaky hand wiped the tears from his eyes. He could not understand why the vision had affected him so strongly. Was that a premonition? He wondered. Or something actually happening at this very moment? And why is it of any importance to me? Thereafter he was unable to continue resting. His worries returned in force and assailed him without reprieve, gnawing at his mind like a host of